Good morning and welcome. We'll go ahead and get started. I don't know if there's this thing is on or whatever, but I'll see if Caleb shows up. It's great to have everybody. So I am, I'll be doing the contemporary martyrs. So Mac was scheduled for today for Latimer and Ridley, but we pushed that off. So he's out of town, so you can be a prayer for Mac and Marilette. They're out of town with some family stuff. So I got pushed up and I'm filling in today. So we'll get started in here. And Mr. Brett, could you open us in prayer?
Yes. God, we just thank you that whatever happens in our world, whether it's somebody being martyred, a thing we don't understand, you can use that for your glory. God, we're thankful that we can look back at, and see your hand in history. And Lord, as we do that today, we need to be encouraged to just see people that are so strong in their faith that they're willing to die for you. Lord, what a great witness that is. In Christ's name,
amen. Thank you. So yes, so I have contemporary martyrs. And so when I was kind of given this one, I was like, I'm not too sure how to cover this one. Like, what qualifies like as a contemporary martyr? How do we evaluate these things? If we see in the news that this or that happens. Actually, if you Google it, like martyrs, like modern martyrs or martyr from whatever last year, basically it almost comes up exclusively as Roman Catholic. I don't know if the church pays for that word or something to be in their advertising or whatever. I don't know. So then it's like, well, how do we consider Roman Catholics that might be killed out there? How do we consider, or even later, one of our situations, different kinds of faith groups and stuff like that that aren't necessarily ours? Because then there's Muslims that will press for martyrdom and be excited about quote unquote martyrdom and some of their more like extreme side of things. So then for a good question for us is, what are contemporary martyrs and like how we can evaluate that? So I've got a few stories for us today, just some stuff to think through with it. So how do we evaluate our contemporary martyrs? So I've got some thoughts kind of as we look at it. Like the first one I have for us is that we think of it like honored. And that's kind of the story, or like Augustine of Hippo there. He describes martyrs as holy men who fought or stood for truth, even unto death, so that the word of God may be made known and falsehood and fictions be overcome. Such a sacrifice is offered to God alone. Thus, the martyr is received in heavenly honor. This means that God has rewarded the faith of the martyr with so much grace that death, which seems to be the enemy of life, becomes in reality an ally that helps man enter into life. Kind of the flip side of things, whereas death actually means being ushered into life for the Christian. The eternal perspective, salvation in Jesus Christ, standing up for that just means you get to heaven faster, right? For some folks. So Augustine, mentioned that. He's from, 5th century? And he's writing kind of coming out of the Roman Empire that was heavily persecuting Christians and killed a lot of Christians. But then he was kind of on the back end where there was no more persecution. And so people that didn't stand up to persecution were then trying to come back into the church. And there was a lot of issue taken up on that. So when he writes it, he's kind of writing from this, well, if we had these, these people didn't suffer because they, denied Christ or whatever it was. But now that we don't have this public persecution, suddenly these folks are wanting back into the church. And there was an issue about that. So some were saying, do we let them back in? Or do we say, no, you're on your own kind of thing? And what this means. So there was that. But he said, if one is to die for their faith, then they are to be honored. And I think that's kind of, we teach this class to honor them, to reflect, to learn lessons, to say, and to learn about sacrifice for Christ, essentially. So that's why we do this one. But we can also see that it can be romanticized, as we've seen in another one, a few other ones, because I think it was who did the one on Justin Martyr and a few others where there was a push to say, oh, you have to go get martyred. So there were early church Christians that were trying to get arrested in order that they could be martyred because there was kind of this idealism about it, this romanticism. So one quote I found in a series of biographies by this one She was writing in the 1850s. I longed to be a martyr. That was her line. I longed to be a martyr. When I see what is the need, I feel that if I had 20 lives, I would gladly give them. So she had been to a number, like in the mid 19th century, there was a lot of excitement around missionary endeavors, going to different, you know, very austere places in the world, kind of because of the writings of like David Livingston and pastors like Charles Simeon preaching about missions and things overseas. William Carey's book becoming very widely known, An Inquiry to the Conversion of Nations. So there's a lot of like fervor around it. They're like, oh, you gotta go into missions and do this, you know, go to these crazy wild places. And so there's kind of this romanticism about it, even as John Payton, which we'll maybe see a little bit later, because he was a missionary that went to the New Hebrides, and he was always told, don't go there, you'll get eaten by cannibals. Because several other missionaries had gone there and got eaten by cannibals. And so he decided to go. And then, so when, like, some of this, my goal with this one is to say, so if we put ourselves in the context of maybe the ones that we hold up as these great missionaries and things like that, some of them were killed and some of them not. Like, if we were in that modern day, how would we, if we were in that time with them, how would we reflect on what they did? So the same as we hear news stories about people now, even this in 2024, how do we reflect on what they were doing and where they were and things like that? Because some of that, they go together. So some of this is just to kind of be like, are we overly romanticizing some folks? Are we not honoring them enough for things that they did? Are we going too far one way or the other? So there's kind of, studying some of these things, there's kind of two different little paths that we can look at martyrs, or two, if you want to call them kinds of martyrs, I guess you could say. So specific is the ones that we've been studying mostly. A lot of like the British pastors and clergy that were killed under, you know, when there was a change of kings or queens, and they specifically said, deny Christ, or deny this, or quit preaching, or we're going to burn you. And they said, no, I'm not going to quit talking about Jesus. And so then they burned him. Like, very specific tie to a question that says, you know, quit doing this, or we're going to kill you. Or as the story of, like, Gladys Aylward, when she recounts the Chinese students in the 1940s and 50s, that when they were asked, do you believe in Jesus? And the first girl says yes, and the Chinese authorities kill her. And then they go to the next student and say, do you believe in Jesus? They say yes, and then they kill that one, and so on down the line. So very specific. But then we can also look at what then is, broadly speaking, martyrs that are considered, that were killed because they were doing what Christians do, essentially. Christians, either pastors at a local church or missionaries just doing the work of evangelism in a foreign field and are killed kind of in the line of fire, so to say. We'll see. We'll learn about Nate Saint and his team in the next couple weeks. Michael Munsell's doing that one. And that's one that we've kind of highlighted here before as far as missions goes. But some would call them martyrs and some would call them not martyrs, because they weren't necessarily being challenged to be like, oh, you believe in Jesus, you know, political or something like that. They were just in a very dangerous location. Yeah. So there are some that would say these don't count as martyrs. Yeah. And there are some that say they do. So just as we're thinking through contemporary ones, because we've always just heard of as described as martyrs, right? So even now, when we hear stories of missionaries and things out there in the world that have happened, even here in 2024, do we consider them martyrs? And why? Those kind of things. I'm not going to say one, I'm not going to judge one way or the other, but just some of the ways that, as we get social media feeds, let's be judicious. Would that be a good word? Let's be discerning and how we read news and stuff like that. So I'm going to introduce you to a handful of folks, and then some that we can pray about and things like that. But I'll be curious to see if anybody remembers some of these from recent years. So the first one we have is John Allen Chow. Or Chu, I don't know how to say it. It's a Chinese name. John Allen Chow. Anybody recognize that name? Or I guess his picture's kind of faded here. Anybody recognize it? You two back there, you know this one? You've heard of this one? Yeah. So John Allen Chow is originally born in Alabama to Chinese immigrant parents. He grew up in Vancouver, Washington, though. I could not find any information specifically about his conversion, but definitely he went to Oral Roberts University, which is kind of a Christian holiness or charismatic university in Oklahoma. And after he attended there and studied physical science or workout science, whatever that's called.
Kinesiology.
There you go, something like that. Yep. And he was very much so impacted by missionaries David Livingston and a missionary named Olson. So David Livingston was kind of the Africa explorer that disappeared into the bush. And then when one of the other, folks found him, Dr. Livingston, I presume, since you're the only white dude within a million miles, right? Or whatever it is. So the classic line. So he's very much so influenced by Livingston. So when he finished school in 2017, John Allen Chow then, he went to a school or a training program in Kansas City called All Nations, which is about missionary boot camp. So it was kind of this, how to live in rugged and austere locations and to depend on yourself and your faith and stuff like that. I guess it's relatively challenging. Are you guys familiar? You all familiar with that school?
Yeah.
Have you been there?
No.
Oh, okay. Just curious. I've been kind of curious to see if anybody knows some of these folks or came across them somehow. But very influenced in recent years because of the New Testament text that there will be, that at the throne, worshiping God is people from every tribe, language, and nation. So very, very much so driven by this kind of modern missionaries movement with that. And so in 2018, he traveled to the Indian Ocean. So he had done a number of hiking things. His social media was full of really long kayaking trips, hiking all kinds of mountains all over the world. A lot of this kind of traveler, wanderlust type social media, which is has been very common over the last handful of years. All the cool swag that goes with that. I worked at REI, so I'm there's all kinds of swag that goes with this stuff, right? And there's kind of this cool. It's super trendy. It's really popular to be like, oh, look at me, I'm on some crazy mountain. Oh, yeah. Rather than taking a picture of the mountain, take a picture of me on the mountain. So there's a lot of criticism about this person because his social media is completely full of it. So as others have said that he actually had been working on this plan for several years. So, and as it unfolds, you might recognize having seen this headline in the news. So he had made a plan for a couple of years and his goal was to go to the North Sentinel Islands, Sentinelese, I guess, is, I can't say it, for whatever reason. But it's in the Bay of Bengal, not too far from Myanmar, but it's controlled by India. And there's a tribe there that has had no official contact with the outside world on one of these islands. So he's had a plan for several years in order to go and reach this tribe. So he had very much so planned it out, knew how to get to the island, knew who to pay off to drop him off at the island. The Indian government had tried to contact these people a couple of different times, but then realized really quickly that these people didn't want to be contacted, and so they hadn't been. So the Indian police, Indian government actually patrols around the island to make sure nobody disturbs these people. There's about 100, 200 is some of the numbers I've gotten that actually live on the island. It's not huge, so it's only 20 square miles, so it can't support a massive population. But there's been, some people are like, oh, leave it because it's primitive and doesn't need to be touched. We're scared if there's diseases, if we Westerners or something go there, then we may introduce all kinds of pathogens to their culture and stuff. And so it's kind of this little greenhouse location that people think is really cool to leave alone, almost like they're watching a zoo in their natural habitat kind of thing, which is really odd too, because there's people that are really critical of this guy because he went and he tried to meet them. So in November of 2018, he paid off some fishermen to drop him off outside the island, 500 yards off or so. He kayaked to the island, I think on the 14th of November, and he was able to converse with them a little bit. They yelled at him. He tried to just copy the words and say them back, but in his journal he says that they were probably cursing at him, telling him to go away, and so they just kind of laughed at him and they threw spears and arrows at him. So he jumped back in his boat and paddled away, but then he felt really bad for leaving. So in his journal he says, I'm going to go back tomorrow. So then he actually writes this in your notes, you have it there. So he writes this to his parents that night. And this is what he writes. "You guys think I'm crazy in all this, but I think it's worth it to declare Jesus to these people. Please do not be angry at them or at God if I get killed. Rather, please live your lives in obedience to whether he has called you to. And I'll see you again when you pass through the veil. This is not a pointless thing. The eternal lives of these Sentinelese tribe is at hand, and I can't wait to see them around the throne of God worshiping in their own language as Revelation 7, 9 through 10 states. I love you all, and I pray none of you love anything in this world more than Jesus Christ. Sola Dea Gloria." So he writes this, and then the next day, according to the fishermen, there's some pictures. So the fishermen drop him off, he goes up to the island, they see some interaction, and then they see the tribesmen essentially kill him and carry him away. And they buried him somewhere on the beach. So that's kind of the end of his story. Now that created quite the social media uproar. It's kind of the aftermath. Some missionaries saying, or you know, Christians, evangelical Christians saying, "That's fantastic, go get them." You know, and more wanting to go do it. The Indian government doubling, tripling their protection of the island. A lot of people saying, "How could you do something so crazy? Like, why would you do that?" And then others writing about how they are making plans to go and try to reach this tribe at a later date. So that's kind of the story of this guy. And I don't know, like based on my internet searches and stuff, I can't find a whole lot more of anybody who made it to the island since then or kind of the passion. But so some of the criticism is that he was just going to the island to try to get a social media thing because of his hefty social media platform. And then some of it is like, no, he really did want to try to meet these people. And we do have biblical texts that say every language, tribe, and nation. So their language on this island, nobody knows it, and nobody has any idea how to speak to them. So so he had a goal of going to do that. So when we evaluate this and we see it in the news or the social media world, is it to be honored? Is it overly romanticized? Is it specific? Is it broad? Those kind of things. So it's just something to think about as we continue on. And we'll get to the end with some of the applications that kind of come from this, because I want to introduce you to a few more people. Anybody recognize these two? Are these three? Jenny does? You all do? Yes. You know them? Have you any chance met them? Okay.
I know Natalie's dad. That's my connection, so that one I'm
right. Baker, yes, because he's state of Oklahoma.
State rep in Missouri. Yes. Yeah, we're in fellowship together.
Yep. So most of the information we have on them actually comes from him.
Yes.
And David's parents. So David himself, or as he goes by Davey, because his dad's name is also David Lloyd. His dad and his parents, David and Alicia Lloyd, have been missionaries in Haiti since 2001. So they established a mission agent or a mission center down there with a handful of churches in 2001. It's called missionsinhaiti.com is kind of their newsletter and stuff. And so Davey here grew up in Haiti. And Haiti has historically been a very politically unstable place. Even UN peacekeeping missions have basically pulled out of there because it's a free-for-all. But these missionaries opted to stay. Now the parents, David and Alicia Lloyd, have been back in the States for the last 6 months or so, probably raising money and things like that. And it's very difficult to get. They came out at a time when they could, and from what I understand, they've had a difficult time trying to get back. So this event has happened, and there's not a whole lot of information because nobody can actually get there. And because communications are so poor in Haiti that they're not really entirely sure all is what's going on. So this is still an actively developing story in some cases. So the most recent, so essentially what happened with them is, well, Davey went to college also in Oklahoma and met his, you know, fiance or married. They got married in 2000. Or 2023, so they'd only been married for a year, but met Natalie there. And the story goes that when he went to school and there were girls that were interested in marrying him, his rule for dating was, "I'm going back to Haiti." So if you're uncomfortable with the whole thought of being in one of the world's most dangerous places, then you should not, then, or not a thing, right? So that's apparently how he turned down several girls that approached him, you know, kind of thing, when he was in Bible college, right? He said, I'm going back to Haiti, you know, so you're welcome to come along, but just know what you're getting into. So, and for the most part, it was relatively, they were basically left alone by the gangs for the most part, for the handful of years that they were there. From what I could tell, they operated like a bakery, they operated a hand, there were a couple of churches that they were associated with, some Bible school stuff, some education and things like that, because the education system down there is so poor. So the last newsletter that I could find, like missionary newsletter that they sent out, this is not its entirety, this is an excerpt I provided for you, but just kind of describes what they're up, what they were up against there in Haiti. So, and this is the January through March newsletter. If you go to the website, you can look up the 2023 and 2022. There's a little bit more detail for those. But this is like the last one that they posted. Missions in Haiti has been able to operate in spite of all the headwinds. Good Hope Church has been open for every service, even while there was shooting close by at times. Good Hope School only had to close for 3 weeks so far this year, and most of the 450 students enrolled have been able to attend classes. Our staff is discouraged, but they are faithful to come to work and to attend church services. And our bakery has been a godsend. The bakery is operating at full capacity, and a lot of people in this area depend on the bakery for sustenance since the gang shut down travel and commerce. We appreciate, so this is the parents writing this letter. We appreciate David and Natalie. They stepped up and have been a tremendous blessing to the missions in Haiti and to the Haitian people in this area. They love and help take care of the kids in the House of Compassion. They preach at Good Hope Church and lead our children's church and Sunday school. We ask God to provide dedicated people to work with us and allow us to expand our outreach. And Davey and Natalie are an answer to prayer. So the parents are writing this letter. I think the parents were actually back in the States at this time trying to do some more fundraising and stuff. And what happened, this was just this last May, right? This is, yeah, Jude Morris Montes. So he is a local national, he's the pastor at this Good Hope Church. So they're missionaries that kind of help operate a number of different little ministries, but he was the pastor. And from what it sounds like is they were at the school, which is at one location, and a gang came by and beat them up, threw them into the building and stole a bunch of their stuff, and then bugged out because the other gang was coming. So they came out of the school and headed over to the church to try to, you know, get out of the way. And when they went over to the church, just to, like within the next few hours, another gang came and plundered the place and actually shot all three of them right outside the church. I could not find a whole lot of information on Jude himself, but he's the local national. So they have the opportunity to leave, you know, get out because they're Americans and, you know, the American, you know, because the American embassy isn't even there now. But they had the option of leaving, but he doesn't. So he's the pastor at that church, and so the one he's the one doing the preaching while there's gunshots going off outside. He's the one that's just doing the work of a local church in Haiti, which I think is, because most of the American media is all about the missionaries that were there, and I don't want to downplay anything that they're doing or anything like that, but I think it's a very helpful reminder to us that as the politics and stuff shift and change, what was he doing? He didn't opt to leave. He didn't avoid church, and his people didn't avoid church. They just... He just did faithful work of the ministry. So in some ways, like that, those categories, specific or broadly, it's like he was doing what God called him to do and was killed. Was it happenstance or was it deliberate? We don't know if there was a conversation or anything that happened with all that. We don't know. But it is a helpful reminder to us that even as political, this is maybe more political changes and things like that, what do? We just stay faithful to the work of the ministry. Just being a faithful pastor. So when everybody else had the option to leave, he decided to stay. He was married with two kids, and I couldn't find any information about the family, where the family is. So you can be in prayer for that. I assume they're still in Haiti. So this is the newsletter that I read for you. But I have another one to introduce you to after all the frustrating things. But here's another one. Anybody recognize him? Was he part of your endorser?
No,
he was a different one. So Dale Getz, this one kind of goes in line with just doing ministry, kind of where you're at, and happen to be in an odd spot. So Dale Getz, he is originally from Oregon, grew up in Oregon and went to a Christian high school there. And then he felt a call to ministry, and so he went to Central Baptist Theological Seminary in outside of Minneapolis and went to seminary there. He then joined the Army as a chaplain. I couldn't really find a whole lot of information. So some of the stories about him being at seminary was, in order to pay for seminary, when he went to school, one of the stories shares that he had a job at I don't know if it was for a general contractor or something, but one of the professors had just bought a house and was new to the school and needed some help getting the house refit. And he was like, oh, my company has all this leftover paint. Could you use it? And so he brought 30 gallons of different colors of paint to this professor, and for a small house outside of Minneapolis, and was like, will any of this work for you? Just the key is, so he said, I can get you paint, but the key is you have to take all of it and dispose of it if you don't use it, kind of thing. So they agreed to it, and so he had 30 gallons of paint that he took to the professor's house and helped the professor paint, because he was new to the seminary and was just getting started and getting ready for classes. So as a student, he helped him paint everything. He joined the Army after that then, and had deployed a couple of times to a handful of, Iraq in 2004, 2005, and he deployed to Afghanistan in 2010. And had only been there for about a month, and then was killed by a roadside bomb outside of Kandahar. And I was aware of his story even as I became a chaplain, but I don't know if I had ever heard anybody specifically call him a martyr. But something had reminded me of there was one of the installations, I think in Colorado, had dedicated a new building and had put his name on it. So it kind of came up in my social media feed in the last few months as, this building is dedicated to Chaplain Captain Dale Getz. And so a handful of pastors that I'm aware of, because he comes from a traditional Baptist thing. So there's a handful of pastors that I know knew him. So on all their social media, they're like, oh, it's great to see this happening and that he's not forgotten and stuff like that. So his professor, the one that he helped with paint, wrote this about him. In ministry, however, and especially in death, Dale became more than just a considerate person. Once he made the decision to enter the chaplaincy, he gave himself to his ministry. He longed to be Christ's instrument to make a difference in the lives of United States soldiers. Dale accepted risky duty without murmuring. He served joyfully in Iraq, and after a time in Okinawa, he willingly accepted the duty of shepherding troops in Afghanistan. That is hard ministry. As far as Dale was concerned, his life belonged to the Lord Jesus to use or to use up. He knew that he had to earn the right to minister to soldiers by sharing their discomforts, even their risks. Indeed, chaplains endure special risks. They wear the uniform, so they are targets, but they do not carry weapons. They only carry their message. For a chaplain, to die in the line of duty is a very significant event. He doesn't mention it here, but he's the only one that has died
since Vietnam.
In
combat.
Yes. For a chaplain to die in the line of duty is a very significant event. The chaplaincy represents a form of self-sacrifice that is rarely seen in Western civilization. Every soldier knows that a good chaplain, like Dale, is doing more than his duty. Every soldier, every airman, sailor, and marine knows that a good chaplain ministers because he's committed to something greater and higher than the unit and the flag that he serves. Dale's commitment to God made him the kind of chaplain that he became. He went where he did not have to go, and took risks that he did not have to take in order to gain the opportunity to share Jesus. Jesus Christ with souls who would not otherwise hear the way of salvation. He did all this knowing that he could never defend his own life. By dying as he did, Dale Getz has gained his place in the noble company of the martyrs. So I knew of his story and had never thought of that. But when this was reposted, so the original posting happened at the funeral, but then this professor, the seminary professor, Kevin Bowder, reposted it when they were dedicating the building, and that's how I found it. And I was getting ready for this class on martyrs, and I was like, huh. I knew the story of Dale Getz, but I don't know if I had ever considered him as a martyr. So that got me to thinking, as we were going through this class, what qualifies broadly specific, romanticized, things like that. And I found it very encouraging. So one of the stories about him, too, is that he specifically in his local missions there in Minneapolis, there's a lot of Muslims in that area. And so while he was in seminary, there's a lot that said he hosted Bible studies and regularly tried to evangelize Muslims. And this was before 9/11. Mm-hmm. So they one of the stories is that actually on September 10th, 2001, he had a Muslim over to his house for dinner and was sharing the gospel with him that night. So it's kind of an interesting, like trying to reach the people that would ultimately kill you in an odd sort of way.
Did he have a family?
Yes. So a wife and two boys, I believe. There are pictures of the family at the dedication, so the boys now are fully grown. And I don't know much about them other than just looking up the story. There wasn't a whole lot of information, family information in the obituaries and stuff like that. So yes. So that is Chaplain Dale Getz. And there is a little bit more. This Kevin Bowder has written a handful of times about him. But otherwise, we don't have a whole lot of biographical information. Yes?
Where is the building in Colorado that you mentioned?
It is, I believe it is on Fort Carson. Yeah.
Is it a chapel?
It is not a chapel. It's a dining facility. Yes. Because I was wondering, did they build a new chapel? Did they name it after him? But no, it's a dining facility. Which is great, because some people, it would be too bad if it wasn't a chapel. But actually, because there's a lot of ministry that chapels can accomplish through the dining facility, and so I was like, that's really cool. Yeah, and because, having been to a number of installations and seeing names and stuff, like, a lot of the other names on there are, like, former U.S. presidents and some, generals and stuff, like Patton or Vandenberg, these big-time generals and stuff like that. But then they actually have a move over the last handful of years is to have more names of folks that have been killed in combat from different ranks and backgrounds and everything. So it's been kind of fun to see how that has shifted. But it is cool to see his name on there, yeah.
The only other chaplain who, there's a chaplain from Iraq, Catholic priest, who finally died of the wounds that he was not killed in combat, but survived, lived another 5-10 years later.
Yep.
That's the only other combat-connected death since,
Wow. And it's one of those, I had never, he's just doing his job. So I had never considered him a martyr. Like, that's what he signed up for.
He wouldn't be there if it weren't for his faith.
Right.
The mission, what he's doing.
So the mission and his faith, trying to reach soldiers. Because also, I don't know about the Army or the Marines, but as Air Force, they always tell us, you're not going outside the wire, you're not doing that stuff. So statistically, that's not likely for some of us in blue. But for other career, chaplains and the other services, that means he willingly, he wasn't assigned to that post. That day, he went and looked at the roster and said, I'll go with these guys. And that's, that kind of stuff. And so when we get to our little bit of application there at the end, then we'll highlight that. So another piece kind of with this. And this one is a little bit more specific. We were talking about broad considerations. This one's a little bit more specific. And this just comes from a Time magazine article by this Palmer Tantsev, Russia's War Against Evangelicals. So this was published just a few months ago. And this has been known, but I hadn't seen maybe more specific writing about it. Excuse me. Some of it is because the Russians invaded and went so far, and then over the last year they've been kind of pushed back, and so we've seen some of the results of what has happened. But this is an excerpt from that article. Russia's invasion of Ukraine is accompanied with a strategic effort to repress, control, and crush religious groups outside of the Kremlin-controlled Moscow Patriarch, the Russian Orthodox Church. There are over 30 cases of religious clergy killed or kidnapped, 109 cases of interrogations, forced expulsions, imprisonments, arrests, 600 houses of worship destroyed. These are just the confirmed numbers, with the real numbers in information blackout of the occupied territories, they will likely be much higher. Evangelicals are targeted by the Russians disproportionately. There was a pastor named Azat, a Baptist children's pastor, that was interrogated and beaten and survived. The Russians left him alone, but he was kind of telling some of the story. So the article adds more about him. But Azat's story is typical for Russia's systemic persecution of Protestants in occupied Ukraine. Protestants were the victims of 34% of the reported persecution event, 48% in the Zaporizhia region where Azat was held. Baptists made up 13% of the victims. the largest single group after Ukrainian Orthodox. Under Russian control, 400 Baptist congregations have been lost, 17% in total in Ukraine. Now, I know we're not a Baptist group, and this was published by Baptist Standard, which I believe is a Southern Baptist publication of some kind. So they were looking at specifically Baptist congregations. And so when I was in Europe about almost 2 years ago now, we were doing training for chaplains in Ukraine. And some of the conversations, so my boss went to an event where like the chief of chaplains of the Ukrainians was there. And so he was asking him, so how are like clergy that are not Ukrainian Orthodox, how are they functioning? And he said, basically, as the Russians come to town, all the other civilians leave, and our chaplains are basically the pastors that are still left. And so the pastors that opted to stay behind have stayed, as everybody kind of tried to leave town, they've stayed, and they're caring for whomever they come across, kind of regardless of faith background or anything like that. And this is like, so when the Russian, or when the Soviet Union fell, because I remember this one, like in the 90s, there was one of my friends in school, his parents were like, we're going to be missionaries in Russia. And I was like, isn't that like the Soviet Union? But this was the mid-90s, and I still hadn't figured out that there was a thing called the Soviet Union, and, you know, there was Russia that was open. So I remember them being like, oh, there's a lot of missionaries going to Russia now. And so they packed up and left. And I was like, why would you go to Russia? It's cold, miserable there. I don't know. I was like 10 or whatever. So they went for like a year, and I think they were in more of a Latvia area, and closer up to St. Petersburg and stuff like that, those missionaries. But because of that move, there's a lot of different denominations and stuff out there. So a lot of American evangelicals went and planted churches and evangelized. But then as Russia, you know, has kind of grown back, a lot of them have had to come back to the States, but those congregations have been left behind. And they're still doing work and ministry there. So when I'm talking to this one, my boss was visiting with one particular Ukrainian chaplain, and he's just like, all our chaplains are volunteer. They're just pastors at local churches, whether they be Assemblies of God, they're Baptist, they're Bible, they're Presbyterian, whatever it is, they've just stayed with their building and continue to minister to whoever shows up. And he mentioned a lot of them. Well, kind of casually, my boss, because he even kind of beats himself up over this, but my boss said, he said, well, it'd be great to see you next year. And he said, yes, if I'm still alive. Mm-hmm. Fully knowing, expecting, because they're serving as religious leaders, that the lifespan of a religious leader on the front is only a few months. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of and because the question, and we asked, and some of it's still classified or whatever, but it is like the Russians are asking, are you this? Are you a Baptist? Are you this? Because they're associating Baptist or Assemblies of God or Bible with being an American. Yes, so they're executing as they go because they consider, they're calling them spies and all this kind of stuff. So that's been, more and more numbers are coming out on that. So that's not to scare you or anything like that. But I would say he's still alive as far as I know as of a month ago. But he's a Baptist minister in Ukraine. He's not right on the front. He's kind of ministering in an area where the Russians have been pushed out of. So he's there, but this is his family. I met him about a month ago. And so his prayer card was on my desk this morning when I was putting this together. I was like, oh, I should include a picture. But so I met him about a month ago, but that's the work that he's doing. So he's fine and alive as far as I know. But that's kind of the political stuff. So how then shall we understand this? So we're at Witten Avenue Bible Church in 2024. How shall we understand this? All right, what is important for us to do? So some of the observations, and this is kind of just looking at a lot of the martyr stories and things that we've talked about over the past month or so. And one of the ones that keeps coming up is risk. What is risk? So some of you that come from the business world, like, what is risk? And what kind of risk do you take? And then, do we think through our risk, taking risk, which is a great board game, by the way. You think through risk theologically.
Risk is space for faith.
Space for faith?
I don't. There's a risk. I don't know what's in front of me, and I step into it,
mm-hmm.
not knowing unknown. So there's, it's not blind faith necessarily.
Right.
But it is, like, there's a little booklet I think Piper wrote, Risk is Right. Like, you ought to risk rejection.
It is. It's. I think it's important because there's, like, our. I think in a lot of ways we're very risk averse.
Yes.
We're nervous about risk, whether it be taking certain kind of costs and taking on certain programs, plans, things like that. Even as we, like, think through missions or building projects or whatever it is, what kind of risk are we going for? Because a lot of ours, yes.
Yeah, David, I you know, when I think of risk in business, as far as what we're seeing, I think it's an uptick right now as far as your desire to proclaim the gospel to people that work for you and even around you. It definitely, with the whole ESG movement out there, but I don't think we have to be afraid of it. You know, I mean, it's like, so what? You know, in some respects, so what? You know, and, you know, people go, yeah, you can't say this or that. You know, well, yeah, I understand. There's areas you need to be careful of. You know, they're being prejudiced. Those kind of things are important to be careful of, but to proclaim the hope and the joy that is found in Christ, you know, I would say, so what?
Yeah.
Go ahead. I had a guy I talked to, maybe it was like 6 months ago. It was a business call. I called him up and I said, I talked a little bit. I need to talk about some kind of strategy on a project.
Yep.
And he says, Steve, I want to, because he's about my age too. He says, I want to tell you something, Steve. What you did when we met, I go, when did we meet? Well, maybe 15 years ago or 20 years ago. And you prayed for the meal. He said, that was a huge thing for me. You know, and I go, what? You know, praying for dinner, and I was like, there's no big deal, just pray, you know. He goes, no, you're a group of business guys, and you just pray. It's like, it was a big thing for him to get more serious about his faith in his business. And he says, thank you. I go, I don't know. So why haven't I done that more?
Yeah.
You know? And I would say it's that for business owners or people that are in the marketplace, you know, so what?
Mm-hmm. Good. Thank you for sharing. So one of the Bible texts that I kind of go with this is 2 Corinthians 11, 23-33. You can look it up, but yeah, let's do that. Let's see. Kind of helps put in perspective maybe how Paul thought of risk.
David, it was interesting. We spent years with Wycliffe Bible Translators, and we watched them balance leaving fields because they felt our people were too much in danger.
Mm-hmm.
And as those people came home, a lot of them had strong feelings that they shouldn't have been pulled out.
Yep.
They would have stayed. So it was a fascinating dynamic in the, because they often came home to the center. We worked out in North Carolina for an extended stay.
Yep.
And one of those became a good friend. And I could talk to him today. He's in his upper 70s, and he would still tell you it was a mistake. They never should have pulled me out.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing, because there's a lot of stories like that. Should they have stayed? Should they have not? I think we covered Eric Little last summer, and that was the same question. That actually came up in here. It was like, because he sent his family home, but he didn't leave. And the question was, well, why not? And then he was killed, and he died in a prison war camp. So 2 Corinthians 11, 23-33, and that one says, are they servants of Christ? I am a better one. I am talking like a madman, for great labors, far more imprisonments, with countless beatings, and often near death. 5 times I received at the hands of the Jews, the 40 lashes less one. 3 times I was beaten with rods, once I was stoned, 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day, I was adrift at sea, on frequent journeys, in danger from rivers, danger from robbers, danger from my own people,
danger from Gentiles, danger in the city, danger in the wilderness, danger at sea, danger from false brothers, and toil and hardship through many a sleepless night, and hunger and thirst, often without food and cold and exposure. And apart from other things, there is the daily pressure on me of my anxiety for all the churches. Who is weak and I am not weak? Who is made to fall and I am not indignant? It is just a reflection. He's arguing against false teachers that would question his reputation or whatever, or his motives. And he just puts out there, like, look at the risks and the things that I've undertaken. Yes?
Just specifically looking at that case of John Chow, you know, there's that tension, and I feel like I understood some of that, you know, working in Kenya for many years, of really desiring to glorify God and make less of yourself,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, the flesh also being there, and there's danger in all that social media and kind of living up to an image that, you know, I ask myself a lot, you know, am I doing this for God or is this more for me, you know? And those are tough questions, I think important questions to ask. Paul also said that you can actually give your body to the flames, and if there's not love,
yeah.
then it's not there's no meaning to it.
Yeah. Right.
It's essentially, I mean, I take that as a unnecessary or worthless death.
Yes.
On the other hand, he said, you know, whatever their motives are for preaching Christ, at least Christ is preached. So,
yep.
you know, I'm just saying there's tension, and I don't think it's 100% one or 100% the other. There's probably always some kind of mix of God's glory, and oh, there's a little bit of my glory in there too.
Right. Which is totally there, because that's like my number two is beware of romanticizing. Mm-hmm. We can put a whole, yeah, yeah.
I mean, Paul, he went to Rome knowing he would be killed.
Yes.
Lots of times.
Or even when he met with the Ephesians and prayed with them before he left, knowing he wouldn't see them again, or not likely seeing them again. But beware of romanticizing. Like, it's easy for us to look back at the old missionaries and stuff that were killed and be like, oh, these are great people of the faith. But if we were there in that day, would we have had the same analysis of them? Or, you know, those kind of things. So it's just beware of romanticizing either ones from the past or current ones. In Hebrews, run the race that is set before us. Since we have such a great cloud of witnesses, let us run the race that has been set before us.
That's so true. What Dan said. Running the race before you.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times it's an individual decision on what God has called you to do. You know, and you don't go serve God the whole time unless you're called, because it just doesn't work otherwise. So in that calling, you know what you're called to do, you know what your race is, and that's what you need to run.
Yep. And even if we, you know, feel like we failed at one point along the way, then God could still use that in future stuff. So even like, so I have Peyton listed on here, John Peyton, missionary to New Hebrides in the mid-19th century. So come back next week. We're not going to learn about him, but more about risk and stuff in that. But he's the one that they said, oh, you're going to be eaten by cannibals, you know. And it's like, well, he took that risk and went, and he survived. He lived to be like 80 years old. But others went to the same islands and were killed. So that kind of thing. Like, run the race that is set before us, and God's working in your own. I even think of John Mark in the New Testament. He went with Paul and Barnabas initially, and then when times got rough or weird, he bowed out, but then we see that he was very much so helpful to Paul in the future in other letters. So God still used those things in him. Peyton actually had to left one island, which he thought he was going to die on, and went to another island, and also thought he was going to die there too, but God blessed him the second island and not the first one, and like, we just have to leave those up to God. Yes.
I think that stepping into faith, and we don't, with the risk, you don't necessarily see it. I think of Nate Satan, Tim Elliott, and the five. That looked like huge risk. I know it's
yeah.
next week. But the fruit, the people change their names, they're evangelizing,
mm-hmm.
the huge outpouring of what happened
yes.
after that.
So some of the ones that we've seen today, we don't know the full story. It's still to be told. But come next week. Dun dun dun. Or in two weeks. Michael Munsell is teaching on the five missionaries that were killed in Ecuador back in the 1950s. So, then the just kind of my final exhortations for you. This came from a mentor of mine. His exhortation was to preach the word, die, and be forgotten. And he borrows that from somebody, I think his father-in-law or something like that. But his exhortation for pastors, chaplains, missionaries, preach the word, die, and be forgotten. I must decrease so that Christ might increase, right? And then the final one, too, a quote from William Carey, which goes on the other side of things, too, is bold witnesses, which we're learning a lot about in the book of Acts. You'll see it over and over again. With boldness, they proclaimed. As bold witnesses, they shared their testimony. Bold witnesses expect great things from God and attempt great things for God. Expect great things from God, attempt great things for God. So that kind of revolutionized modern missions in a lot of ways. God moves in great ways, moves people about, things happen, politics change. But it's always God always uses that as an opportunity for the gospel in different ways. So it's great to see that. But any other thoughts, questions, comments, snide remarks? Reflection.
Yeah, part of the message translation. It's to your first mentor's point.
Okay.
Colossians 3:4.
Yep.
When Christ, your real life remembered, shows up again on this earth, you'll show up to the real you, the glorious you. Meanwhile, be content with obscurity like Christ.
Be content with obscurity. Interesting. Good. Thank you for sharing. Would you close us in prayer?
Sure. Father, thanks for this morning. Thank you for the work that Dave has done and digging down deep and bringing some of your choice servants to the forefront. We can consider their lives. Consider their deaths, Lord. For them to remain is for us, for them to die as Christ. Lord, I pray and ask that you would put that into our hearts, Lord, that we would live well, and if need be, we would die well, but Lord, that we would it would all be for you. And so, Lord, thank you for an opportunity to meditate on these things, share with one another, and then, Lord, I pray that you'd open our hearts for each other as we approach your throne and seek to worship you in this worship service together as your people. We love you, may you enjoy our worship, and Lord, may we enjoy you in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Well, thank you all for your time. Tune in next week to hear more.